Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Were you one of the 60,000 fans at the Emirates watching Russo score? It seemed like the place to be.
It's there. Alessio Russo finishes it off.
Arsenal's average league attendance is now over 35,000. That's higher than half the Premier League clubs. It'd be sixth in Ligue 1 and seventh in La Liga. So, how are Arsenal drawing such big crowds? Is the one club mentality working? And was the performance worthy of the occasion? I'm Sophie Penny, and from The Athletic, this is Full Time Europe.
In a must-win game, Arsenal have done just that.
I'm with The Athletic's Arsenal reporter, Art de Rocher. Hi, Art.
Hello.
We're also with The Athletic's women's football reporter, Charlotte Harper. Hiya, Charlotte.
Hello, Sophie. Hello, Art.
We've got a dream team here today, haven't we, Charlotte? What are we calling? What's our
We're
name?
We're top of the charts. Top of the charts. Charlotte and Art.
Credit to Jay Harris for that one. And happy International Women's Day week as well, I should say. Later, we're going to go more into depth about growing fan bases after that massive Emirates attendance and an Athletic survey that Katie Wyatt did of male fans into the women's game. So I think that's going to be a really interesting chat. Charlotte, you were at the Emirates. Well, you were actually both at the Emirates, weren't you, for this one? 1-0 win for Arsenal over Spurs to keep them in the title race. They're just 3 points behind leaders Chelsea and Man City. Charlotte, you went as a fan. What was the atmosphere like? Was it a real derby?
It was an enjoyable atmosphere. It didn't feel quite like a derby until probably the 81st minute. I was next to the away fan section, so alongside the Spurs fans. And yeah, I was sitting next to my friend Ailey, who said it lacked gumption. And I think it was a bit flat for a derby, but Arsenal won't be complaining about that at all.
What about the 60,000 fans? Could you really feel that atmosphere?
Well, as we were queuing in, there were still loads of fans about 5 minutes before, still trying to get into the stadium. And there were lots of empty seats in the kind of first couple of minutes, and then it packed out. So yeah, I still don't think you could have felt that it was 60,000. I think there's so much more that these games can give in terms of that derby and that atmosphere, and that's part of the growing fan base, which Katie is going to talk about. My little gripe of reporting tickets sold versus the actual attendance. I don't know. Art, do they do that for the men's games as well?
Yeah, so Arsenal, I think it's almost become like a running joke in the men's game anyway. Now I'm sure it'll be like that in the women's game, where there was a point maybe towards the end of Arsene Wenger's time in charge where tickets sold would be reported and it would always be around 60,000 when you could visibly see a lot more empty seats. But again, as I think everyone's starting to find out, tickets sold is just what Arsenal tend to go by when they're announcing their attendances. So
do we know why? Yeah.
I'm not sure if there's any specific reason, really. But yeah, it is something that they've done across both teams for a while.
I just think if you're buying a ticket for £12, that's a big difference to then paying the prices for the men's game. So you have to put a value on it, and then people aren't just going to pull out because the weather's not good or traffic's caused problems or you've got other plans. It shows a willingness and a commitment despite other factors that you still want to go and watch. So brilliant that they've sold out. Would be even better if they report the actual attendance.
Yeah, I think it would make the figure mean a little bit more, wouldn't it? How have they actually got to this point with attendances? Because they are kind of the leaders in the WSL right now with this. And it's not just the effect of the Euros, is it?
No, I think there's a lot of different factors that come into it. They have been playing quite regularly at the Emirates since 2021, so a year before the Euros, when I think it was Chelsea they played on the opening day. And that day, they only really could sell out one kind of segment of the lower tier of the East Stand. So the stand that people who are watching on TV can see with the broadcast camera angle. And then slowly, I think, throughout that season, they started to play there in the Champions League. And then I think you can't really, I guess, underestimate the power of the Euros and Arsenal having not just the England captain in Leah Williamson, but also Beth Mead. I think that did help massively. You can't underplay, I guess, the importance of that. The biggest cheer of the game wasn't for the goal, it was actually for Leah Williamson making her return.
Quite the reception on her return.
I think those are two really big factors, but also you've got the location. It's very easy to get to from central London and even in other areas. And then also on top of that, you've got the fact that not all of these fans are Arsenal men's fans. So there will be a lot more kind of crossover between maybe someone who supports, I don't know, Fulham's men's team and then they kind of fell in love maybe with Arsenal's women's team. So I think you've got that, which helps them quite a lot as well.
I also think that Arsenal were really proactive after the Euros. You had a whole new audience that weren't affiliated to a club. And they were like, well, who do we support? And Arsenal were like, bam, come to the Emirates. We'll give you a nice experience. You'll have food or drinks and accessibility and toilets that... basics that you don't necessarily get at Boreham Wood. Well, you'll have toilets. At Boreham Wood, there's probably one female toilet with a queue of 50 people waiting. It gave them a nice experience, a nice fan experience, and then a willingness to come back and a reason to come back. Arsenal were also really savvy in just running like competitions to win a couple of prizes. Then you get people's data. Then you have their contact details. Then you know where they're coming from. Then you say, hey, come and enjoy these other five matches, get the home advantage package. You know, it sounds simple, but it's the real basics that have allowed Arsenal to flourish. And that one club mentality, you go on the website and you see Arsenal men and women. It's quite easy to buy tickets, not mentioning any other clubs' names, but it's a nightmare to like navigate through their websites. And Arsenal have proved that people want to come, they want to show up, and other clubs should definitely be following suit in terms of their marketing and commercial strategy as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think they made some changes behind the scenes as well. They've combined the men's and women's commercial teams, so now they work together rather than having someone separately on the women's side, which I think will have made the difference. Charlotte, you mentioned those home advantage packs where all those WSL games at the Emirates, I think there's six now, there were originally five, were all sold together. So kind of makes sense that they've broken the league record for attendances three times this season, doesn't it? We've got to talk about what happened on the pitch. Whether the performance was worthy of the occasion, I found quite interesting because I was watching from home and I was thinking how many of these people who've seen the way Arsenal are attacking in this game are going to want to come back for Arsenal's attacking game. Is that really harsh, Art?
No, it's not harsh at all. I think it was a tough watch at times and you could see it was a bit of a grind for the players on the pitch, which then maybe factored into why it was a bit quieter.
Obviously, a lot of that performance was the way it was because Spurs were in a low block and it was difficult to break through. You speak about this in your article, and this is something that Arsenal have had to deal with quite a few times this season, I think it's fair to say. What did you make of how they dealt with it? Do you think that's still an issue for them, or they found a way through with Kim Little, say, for example?
Yeah, I wasn't too A, surprised or B, frustrated with the way they went approaching it, because in the first half, I felt that Pullover and Ford were ridiculously good, even if they didn't have clear-cut openings, just because of how easy it was for them to find space. And then that's kind of what Kim Little was able to do even better with the pass for Beth Mead and her touch as well, which deserves a mention for the goal. I would have hoped that the goal would have opened the game up a little bit more, which I guess comes down to the tight kind of circumstances Arsenal were dealing with coming back from the international break, with three players at the Gold Cup and a lot more debatable in terms of their fitness for the game. So I think it's one where you just do your job, get the 3 points and then move on to the next one.
Grind out the result.
Yeah.
Obviously, I have Viv Miedema out. She's just had a minor knee surgery. She's going to be out for several weeks. Charlotte, you spent a lot of time behind the scenes with Spurs before Christmas. Was this how you expected them to approach the game, kind of in that low block and attacking on the counter? Did you find it quite similar? Because the last time round, obviously Spurs won 1-0 in the reverse fixture, didn't they?
I think they're a bit more reserved than I expected, a bit more defensive. In the first couple of minutes, they were actually, you know, pressing quite high and being aggressive. And then all of a sudden, they just backed off and got deeper and deeper. Spurs tried to hit them with pace in behind. That was their plan, hit on the counter-attack. And let's be honest, Arsenal should have won the December fixture. They had an expected goals value of 2.5 and they didn't score any. So, you know, 9 times out of 10, looking at that game, you would see Arsenal come out on top. But this game was very similar, a 60-40 possession split in Arsenal's favour. Arsenal dominated. They had superior XG, number of shots, shots on target, touches in the box, and final third entries for both games. The difference is that Spurs took that one chance in December and didn't take them this time. And Arsenal and the reverse had so many crosses, so many shots in the December fixture, and one of them came off this time. I think Spurs probably knew that if they were really aggressive, then they would leave pockets and Arsenal would just carve through them. If you look back to the Manchester City result against Spurs where they got thrashed, that's what happened. So, you know, Spurs' mantra, be brave, dare to do. And I think that is being brave in the right areas. They still stuck to their principle of playing out from the back. And at times, I don't know how Art felt, but it was like, oh, because they were really deep and still at times managed to navigate their way around, but then got to their kind of mid play and there were very little off the ball, and then Arsenal would just kind of suffocate them and then regain possession. So it's sometimes damage limitation for Spurs, but it's a reflection of where they're at.
Robert Villaham has said, hasn't he, Charlotte, that next season Spurs will be targeting Champions League qualification, but it is his first season in charge. Last season they were ninth, so 6 is an improvement. And for Arsenal, it's 3 points in the bag. They're still in the title race. Chelsea and Man City leading the way at the top. And it was great news for Chelsea, wasn't it, that US women's national team forward Kat Macario is back from a long-term knee injury. And she scored on her Chelsea debut in that 4-0 win over Leicester. Charlotte, what did you make of Kat Macario and how much of an impact do you think she could have for Chelsea?
I think Macario is a much-needed boost for Chelsea. She's still only 24 years old. She's had just under a couple of months, under 2 years out with that ACL injury. So, you know, Emma Hayes said you have to build her patiently. It's a long, long time to be absent from the pitch. But the way she took her goal, the pass was slightly behind her, but left-footed touch and then to set her up really neatly for that finish. I just think that kind of shows the quality that she has to come. And with Sam Kerr out and Mia Fischel, you know, they need Kat Macario. She's versatile across that front line. She's got a mentality of a winner, playing at Lyon, playing for the US women's national team. She knows when the stakes are high and how to pull out some big performances. So I think with Chelsea being hampered by injuries to Kerr, Fischel and Bright, this is some good news that has come their way.
And Chelsea have got some big games coming up, haven't they? They've got Man City in the Continental League Cup on Thursday, and they're playing Arsenal in the WSL on the 15th of March. So some big ties to look out for. Thank you so much for joining me, Charlotte and Art.
Top of the charts.
Right, let's get off the pitch and into the stands next.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You're listening to Full Time Europe from The Athletic.
I'm with The Athletic's women's football writer, Katie Wyatt. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Sophie. You okay?
Yeah, good, thank you. And we're joined by the head of women's football at the Football Supporters Association, Debs Dilworth. Hiya, Debs.
Hiya, both.
With that big attendance again at the Emirates and it being International Women's Day this week, we wanted to hone in on getting more fans involved in women's football. It's an area we come back to time and time again, but we've got an interesting angle to it today. So Katie has done a survey of male fans of the women's game, which is a really big growth area for getting more fans involved in women's football. Katie, to start off with, why did you want to launch this survey?
Yeah, so I remember being at Manchester Piccadilly Station not that long ago and seeing someone get off the train with a Lauren Hemp shirt, a man. And I was kind of going, oof, and a bit taken aback by it, because women's football in this country, given that it's been banned for so long and has been put down and had so many barriers in its way, it automatically becomes very political and very loaded with so many other implications. So I was looking at them thinking, wow, what a big step forward that a man in his 20s, he's having a women's player's name on his back. And I was thinking, well, would my brother do that? Because he's always been very open-minded about women's football. Is that just a younger generation thing? Or is it because my brother's quite progressive and left-leaning and he grew up with a girl who played football and me as a sister? And I was just having all of these thoughts in my head. So I thought it would be really interesting to just speak to male fans and get their thoughts on how they came into the women's game. Because if they're anything like my brother, he was very open about women's football, but he was also brought up with, as many of us were, given women's football is just taking off in a really mainstream way now, with men's football as the norm. So did he have preconceptions that needed to be challenged, or was he always very open to it? So there were just all of these questions around that were swirling around in my head. So I began speaking to male fans of women's football, but then it became quite apparent when I was looking at what they were saying and typing up that it would have been good to have something a bit more numerical involved in it and a bit more quantitative. So that was where the survey idea happened. And then it just took off a lot more quickly and with a lot more responses than I expected. But I'm really, really grateful that it just took off in that way.
And you had about 5,000 responses, didn't you, over 15 days? And I think something that's really interesting stood out to me in your introduction of your article on The Athletic, where people can read about the survey, is that in Britain, 23% of men watch women's sports compared to 15% of women. And I think that just kind of stood out to me, of actually higher percentage of men watch women's sport than women. So it is something that's really important to touch on. Debs, I wonder how much of your work with the FSA has focused on this area of male fans of the women's game.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting area, and it's a thing that I talk about quite a lot, actually, because often when within my job, I get a lot of people that say, oh, we want like to focus on women in women's sports, but I need to be able to represent everybody that goes to the women's game, and that's men and women. So it's important to sort of understand why, and this is why this survey is so interesting. It's important to understand how men got involved in the women's game and then what continues to take them back. And I think some of those are going to be relating to sort of like the attitudes that happen in a men's game. And so actually the women's game presents an entirely different opportunity and option to like get involved in the game.
We were obviously speaking about Arsenal in the first half of the show. And what Arsenal have done really well is they've got this one club mentality. So that basically means that if you support Arsenal men's team, you support Arsenal women's team. Katie, that seems to be working well for Arsenal in terms of their huge attendances. They keep on breaking the records, don't they? Did you find that that was the case with a lot of men, that they were supporting the same men's and women's team, and they were responding well to that one club strategy?
Yeah, it was something like 75%, which very much suggests that there's merit to what Arsenal are doing and this strategy that the Football Association, when they made the WSL a professional league, very much did it with that strategy in mind, I think, because by making the WSL professional before it can sustain those wages, you're relying on men's football clubs for this medium term to bankroll their women's teams. So I think that was the kind of end game that they had in mind, that it will automatically be that you support one team and you support the other. And we can see that there are clubs where that's worked really well. But given the issues that we've had in the past, where, and even still have now, where there are a lot of Premier League Championship clubs who don't have a women's team or don't have a high profile, well funded women's team, it can be a lot more attractive to go to support one with lots of lionesses. But the rules, if we want to call them rules, tend to be a little bit more flexible. There isn't that history of your granddad has supported Aston Villa, so you all go for generations and generations, and people are finding new or other ways to get into support or to justify their support of teams. And that was really fascinating to me, that there were men who were responding when we asked them for a little bit more detail, saying, oh, I was a Manchester United men's fan, but I got really disillusioned with the Mason Greenwood thing or the Ryan Giggs and Ronaldo allegations, and I just decided I've had enough, but I really admire Mary Earps or Ella too. Or you would have men who say, I just can't stand Chelsea in the men's game, but I really admire Emma Hayes and I like Guru Wright, and so I'm a Manchester United men's but Chelsea women. And then you would have, it was fascinating to me when that survey, then results of our survey went up on the website, because you had people from the men's game being like, this is just absolutely not the way it's done. I can't believe, can't imagine supporting our closest rivals, why are they doing it? But not understanding that the rules in the women's game might be slightly more flexible or slightly different.
I think it's interesting, isn't it, that people are actually having to make that choice as well? Because then once you've got that choice, what does that depend on? Does it depend on, you know, the lionesses that they've seen? You know, is Arsenal potentially particularly popular because it's got so many famous England players in it? I wonder what the fans are using to choose which team they're actually deciding to support.
It's also around, like, the ease of going. So we know that supporters in the women's game and in the men's game, to some degree, there's commonalities, have difficulties in getting to games, information being shared, you know, the stadium, where it's played at, how to get there, all those kind of things. So actually, like, I was in a conversation the other day and somebody said, well, I'm a Liverpool fan, support Liverpool, always have, men's and women's, I can't get there. It's really difficult to get there. It takes me a massive chunk of my day. So I choose to go to Man City. It's a good experience, you know, like, enjoy watching that women's team. So it's often, it can be dependent on, like, locations as well, which then slightly changes the where the supporter goes.
The lionesses one was a particularly big part of it, that we would get messages saying, oh, Manchester City are our closest team and with lionesses in, and my son's a big Chloe Kelly fan or massive Mary Earps fan after the Euros, and that's what we gravitate towards. So I think that that was a real big driver of it. But I think it's an interesting thing to observe more generally, this more flexible support, because when fans come from the men's game, and does that mean that the men's game is always going to take precedent in their affection, or are they going to have more time for the women's game? Are they going to grow to love both equally? And if you're having rules that are a little bit more flexible, does that mean that the fans care less about them because the rivalries are not as big in the women's game? Are they not as big of an Arsenal women's fan as they are Arsenal men's fan? Or is it just the case that this is a totally different sport with totally different conventions, and you can still have a sport that's meaningful and competitive with a little bit of needle and a little bit of competition and friendly rivalry without it boiling over into that tribalism and into that I love Arsenal as much as I hate Chelsea kind of sentiment? So I think that that's just something that's interesting to explore more generally, is the implications of that. But that was certainly something that I found fascinating in the survey.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
You're listening to Full Time Europe with Sophie Penny.
Katie, I'm interested in the expectations that people have, because we've been speaking about kind of how people get into the women's game. If people are coming from a men's team and they go to the Emirates, their experience might meet their expectations of what they're used to at a men's game. But if they're coming to, you know, a Boreham Wood game or something like that, it's going to meet different expectations, isn't it? So it all leads back to this question of the attitudes that come from their experience of men's football and how you deal with trying to kind of satisfy those in the women's game, doesn't it?
Yeah, that was something that I found really, really interesting in the survey, that it was something like 91% that come from the men's game before they went into the women's game, which is obviously a really, really high percentage. And discussing their expectations with them was something that I found really fascinating. And I think the expectations around the atmosphere and the crowds and what to expect is a really vital point of that, because for part two of the project, I was speaking to fans in a little bit more detail and spoke to some Arsenal fans in Tim Silman, who obviously runs the blogs and the podcast that people will be very aware of, but one called Max as well. And Max was talking about how he first started going to Arsenal women 10 years after he began following the men's team, and he went to an away game and there were about 700 people there at the game, and there was no chanting, and he was wanting to start chants, but he felt a bit self-conscious being one of the only ones, and he was just going quite open-minded as to say, well, this is very different to what I'm used to in the men's game, but coming from the men's game into my first women's game doesn't mean that I can say, oh, well, this is how it should be done and this is how it's done in the men's game and we should just copy that. So even being at sort of 2021, he was very aware of what it means to exist in that space and the fact that this might be a slightly different experience. And Tim was talking about how swearing's not been accepted in the women's game before, and now you're getting chants that are maybe copying ones that you've seen from the men's game, or copying the tunes, or you'll get fans just chanting chants with swear words in. And one game, actually, Lotte Vuben-Moy actually said, you know, pack it in, calm down, rein it in a little bit, just aware that the fact that there might be a younger audience there. So that's something that becomes interesting. And I know there was a debate on social media recently in response to an article about Ciara Keating at Manchester City and some of the chanting that was directed at her, and people were saying, well, is this abuse? But other people were saying, oh, well, women's footballers are not really dainty little flowers that you have to protect from any sort of chanting and swearing and aggression. So that is a separate debate in itself of what the culture in the women's game looks like, and the fact that you can have competitions and rivalries in a healthy way for the most part without it boiling over into the aggression and the aggro and the fighting that we very often see in the men's game. So what that looks like as the game reaches a wider audience and a different audience is very much something that I think is open to debate and that we'll see in the next few years. But I think one of the striking things about the survey is that the vast majority of men that I spoke to were very open-minded with the fact that they are coming into something that's very, very different, and they were just prepared to give it a go and see what it was about and know that it's not their place to dominate that space or to say this is how it should be. They were more likely to think, oh, well, the crowds might be lower, or the stadium might not be as big or whatever it is, but I'm going to value it for what it is and see it for what it is. And I was very surprised at just how many men were of that mentality. I'd sort of maybe unfairly expected that a lot more men would go, oh yeah, I was really shocked that it was this tiny ground and there were only 300 people there and there was no chanting. I didn't really like it, but I enjoyed the football or something along those lines. But to hear that a lot more of them were willing to throw themselves into that community was really heartening.
Deb, does that tie into what you've been hearing from fans? Because Katie, I loved that part of your survey. I thought that was really refreshing. Mm. People to say, oh yeah, okay, maybe it might be a bit slower, but we know that women's football was banned for 50 years, so we're just accepting that it's a different environment. It's a very important time to be discussing this as well, isn't it? Because there's a new company that's taking over the league from next season, so it's a chance to make some changes if we want.
Definitely. And like I always say, it's a golden opportunity to maybe not replicate what's happening in the men's game across a number of different areas. So it's, you know, this is really important. I think just in terms of, it's hard because you've got like two different levels of men's fans, I suppose. There's been a lot of male fans that have come over to the women's game because they did just felt disengaged with what was happening at a men's game. So then they've gone, do you know what, actually, and for a really long time, they've consistently supported the women's game. Then you've maybe got like a new wave of people that have been heavily marketed to, and then maybe because it's in a main stadium, it's sort of going, well, this is a football game, this is a match, and so my behavior is going to be exactly the same. And then when the crowds get bigger, you know, it's potentially maybe it's slightly more noticeable because you're just seeing a minority of things happening. And so then touching on Katie's point around the differing attitudes and sort of like them approaching the women's game in a different way and it respecting the space, if you will, I think a lot of our supporters groups have actually taken that approach and have kind of, so like in terms of like songbooks and chanting, women's supporters groups will often actually take that those words out, swearing and stuff out of the singing that they do in to kind of respect what the women's game has, you know, traditionally always been about, which is a welcoming, inclusive space. I was actually just on a phone call with some of my colleagues discussing the element of the Keating article that came out on what classifies as abuse and what classifies as a bit tongue-in-cheek. And I think it is interesting to sort of see the level of difference between like attitudes on this. So, you know, was it just a bit tongue-in-cheek, kind of like, you know, wink and a bit, you know, kind of jovial? Or are we just, do we just have a bit of a low bar? So, you know, like in no other line of work would you, you know, Sophie, if I came over to your place of work and just started saying, oh, I think you're a bit dodgy every 5 minutes, you wouldn't particularly enjoy it. So why are we then sort of repeating some of the same mistakes that might be coming into the men's game? So I think that's what supporters are kind of talking about now. And then with growth, how do we sort of manage that situation? Realistically, there's so many people that go and enjoy the women's game, feel like it's an inclusive space and kind of enjoy it for what it is. You know, you have a lot of different fans that are friends that crisscross over with each other on game day and go to the pub beforehand or to a cafe beforehand to chat. So you still do have those elements. But is this now a time to kind of set the tone of like what we expect as fans going forwards? And, you know, who decides that really?
It's interesting when you talk about growth, because that's what I want to end on. Obviously, we want more fans of women's football, full stop. We obviously want more male fans of women's football, and we know that that's a big resource to draw on. We've been talking about that a lot. But how much are we willing to change the product in order to get those fans on board? So I want a word on you from you both, kind of on the future and where we go with all of these things we've been discussing.
No, I think that that's exactly right. And I think my view on male fans has been that in a financial sense, we probably need male fans or fans from the men's game to make the women's game financially sustainable at the rate of growth we've seen in terms of wages at the top clubs over the last few years. But we've never needed male fans to give women's football an endorsement for it to be legitimate. We've never needed them to say, oh yeah, I watch women's football and therefore it's now valid and proper. So that's something that I've kind of very strongly believe that the game can succeed on a lot of its own values and merits. And I think that you don't need it to suddenly borrow from all of the aggression from the men's game or any particular qualities or trends from the men's game to be valid in its own right. And I would like to think that it can be, sometimes I like to see it as a more forward, or I don't want to say use the word utopian because it sounds very dramatic, but it's a more futuristic progressive version of the game where you can have rivalries, but there's also a real awareness of the fact that of this is what it is in a real perspective, though. It's only just football, it's not worth resorting to the violence and the aggression, and there's a real social conscience. So there's so much of the women's game with the way that the fans can be very thoughtful about certain things, and not that fans can't in the men's game, but it's just a real cornerstone and a real fundamental part of the women's game. And I just think there are so many values that I would really be eager that we preserve. And I think sometimes with fans from the men's game, maybe we've seen that compromise slightly, or we've seen that change with maybe a little bit more rivalry or aggression, and we've seen resistance to that, we've seen some fans really embrace that. But I think for where we are at the moment, with women's football still being something that has been sidelined for so long, and with women playing football being a political act for the next, I would go as far as say 10, 15, 20 years, I think it will only attract people who are of a certain way of thinking. I don't think it will attract, it's not going to attract your Joey Bartons just by virtue of being what it is, because they're not going to want to watch women playing football. So I think for the future, for quite a number of years, we will still see a lot of its values preserved, because it will only attract people of a certain way of thinking and a certain mindset who were open to the prospect of women even playing football.
I'd slightly differ in terms of who we should be aiming at, though. So, yes, OK, we want the support of men and boys. We want to make sure and educate boys and men of the fact that women play football, and that, you know, you can have anybody's name on the back of your shirt, male or female player. It doesn't matter. But the people that I think are then going to be missed out again, and it would be such a shame because of the way that some clubs have now pillaging their season ticket holders in the men's side, is actually middle-aged to older women. Okay, so that market or that category of people have often just missed out on several levels. So now clubs are just completely ignoring them, people that haven't had an opportunity to play, people that feel disengaged with football to begin with, you know, and you're seeing a whole host of like beginner women's sides pop up, but actually the clubs are now not marketing to them. The people with consumer power, the people that pull the punches and some of the decisions on like what kids get, what they buy, you know, merchandise, are women. It's a massive consumer market, and the FSA would advocate for this as well. They have to be genuinely consulted. What do you want from your match day experience? How different does it look? But that's your market. This whole thing of we have to desperately go and get all of our male season ticket holders, it might be a quick win, but you might end up then with some really damaging things happening, because football is just football, you know, mentality. That doesn't account for, you know, we have loads of supporters in the men's game doing absolutely amazing things to try to prohibit some of this. And the majority of people don't want those behaviours. But actually in the women's game, like, why are we not focusing on older women, middle-aged women, you know, mums, partners that go to the game? It kind of is such a shame for me. And then what you're going to do is just survey, it's 23% versus 15%, was it, of women?
Yeah.
So are we just going to make the women's game a more male space again? That doesn't seem to feel quite right.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really significant point. And part of my motivation for doing this survey was that we so often hear about how the women's game's targeting the next generation and young girls. And I was thinking, wait, there are men that support women's football as well? And there was that kind of reaction. And I think that the older women is another demographic that we're missing.
I agree. And the Football Beyond Borders survey also suggested that a way of getting more inner city teenagers into football was through their mums, and their mums being key influencers in their lives as well. So I think it's definitely an area to look at. And there's so many different areas to look at in this, aren't there? It's been a fascinating chat. You can read more about Katie's survey on The Athletic, and you can find out more about what Debs has been doing on the FSA Football Supporters Association website. Thank you so much, Katie and Debs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can read all about that survey and check out our full-time column on The Athletic. To sign up, it's just $1.99 a month for 12 months. Search theathletic.com/WSL. Before you go, please leave us a rating and a review and hit follow on your podcast feed. It means a lot to us. You can also send in your questions to fte@theathletic.com on email or on the socials at The Athletic FC on Twitter and Instagram. Have a fantastic International Women's Day. Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to Full Time Europe, part of the Athletic Football Podcast Network. The producer was Sophie Penny, and the executive producer was Abby Patterson.
To discover and listen to other great Athletic podcasts just like this one, including our brand new Daily Football Briefing, search for The Athletic on Apple, Spotify, and everywhere else you get your audio on demand.
The Athletic.